Yeah, so in the breaks or tomorrow, be chatting about some of these things, you know, and I'm trying to start conversations. I'm not pretending to say the final word, you know, but start conversations because we are talking about areas where we can be of help to each other, right? Well, let's look at chapter 3. And what's this saying about God, and therefore what's it saying about us? Now, even though it's obvious once it's pointed out, people don't always see the close connection between chapters 2 and 3. Why is King Nebuchadnezzar suddenly setting up this great image of gold? Well, what he's doing, of course, is he's trying to prevent the dream of chapter 2 taking place. And his image is like the other image, but see, there's a problem with the image in the dream that he saw. Because apart from the head of gold, the rest was made with inferior metals, and the other parts were kind of composite. The breast and arms, you know, legs and partly of iron and clay and so forth, you know, the vulnerability of this image, and of course it was destroyed. And if it represents the destruction and succession of kingdoms, well, if you're a dictator, if you're the king of the world like Nebuchadnezzar, you don't like hearing stuff like that. So his image is an attempt, a rebellious attempt, to prevent the dream, what's being pictured in the dream. It's an attempt to stop it happening. He certainly doesn't want his kingdom to be replaced by some other kind of kingdom. So there's a very close connection. But now the head of gold becomes a whole image of gold. And again, just as the image in the dream, the human image in the dream, is not an idol, it's not representing God or gods, same in chapter 3, this image that is set up, it's not a pagan god, but it's an image of empire. It's an embodiment, a symbol of empire, the great golden empire of Nebuchadnezzar that he wants to make sure it lasts forever. And the best way to do it is to ensure the total loyalty of the citizens, so everybody has to bow down and do homage to the empire, you see. So again, the image is not, the issue is not idolatry. That's not why the Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego won't bow down or something like that. No. But again, that is to pledge ultimate loyalty to Nebuchadnezzar, and only God deserves that kind of loyalty. But so the very close connection. Chapter 3, in a sense, is a reaction to chapter 2. So I want to point out that connection. And so we've got this great image, very high, very thin. Oh, if only Nebuchadnezzar knew about centre of gravity. Dougal will explain to you after you. Right? Centre of gravity, you know what I mean? Kind of, you don't want anything to be too high and too narrow, because again, even describing this, and we're working with sixes, not sevens, you see. There's a couple of things we're mocking. This is a book full of mockery, the pretensions of human beings when they, you know, getting too big for themselves, you know, thinking that they're in control. We're mocking. They're very tall, but very narrow, and therefore unstable. Image, and we're working with sixes rather than sevens, so there's some mockery taking place here. And also, the extremely repetitive way in which this is written, you see. Notice all the lists and all the repetition. For example, in verse 2, you know, assemble the satraps, prefects, governors, counselors, treasurers, justices, magistrates, all the officials and so forth. And then verse 3, then the satraps, prefects, governors, all these lists. Now, again, it's mockery. because Nebuchadnezzar here sounds like a building monument, like a text on a monument. Ancient, we've got lots of these ancient kind of texts, you know, chiseled on stone and stuff like that. He's sounding like a building inscription. This kind of repetitious way was the style of the kind of things that they used to, you know, put on monuments, like this kind of stuff. So he sounds like an inscription written on a wall. And also, when people bowed, he tells everybody to bow down. Verse 4. O nations, peoples, nations, languages. And notice again, we specify the whole orchestra, horn, pipe, lyre, all the repetition here, we're mocking. You know, this is going to end badly. Nebuchadnezzar's not only doing the wrong thing, he's being extremely foolish. He doesn't know how foolish he sounds, how foolish he looks. We're mocking. And maybe we need to do a little bit more of that, don't we? We do take, you know, we do take people so seriously, don't we? Look, aren't Christians always being mocked? Aren't our values regularly turned into humour on TV and so forth? You know, we can mock, you know, a lot of foolish things happen. We should kind of be, you know, just not only seeing how wrong things are, just seeing the foolishness, the funny side, so to speak. You know, when people set themselves against God, when people try to run a society, but it's not on Christian values, you know what I mean? So we're certainly mocking here in this particular passage. So everybody's got to bow down. They've got to bow or burn, aren't they? We've got the fiery furnace. And of course, most people, therefore, being threatened with death, that's a very good way to control people, isn't it? Most people bow down. And so that's part of the humour, isn't it? It's when human beings start being robotic, not thinking, you know, press a button and they just do what you know. When people start looking like robots, again, we're mocking. We're not only mocking the king, but we're mocking the people who bow down. And it looks as if everybody bows down. In fact, the passage says that, but thankfully we find out there's some exceptions. Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. Now, don't ask about Daniel. Where was Daniel? Well, annual holidays? Sabbatical? it's a story about Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. That's all we can say, right? So don't ask that question, right? Some of these stories feature Daniel, right? This is the story that features Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. That's all we can say. So that's all we need to say, right? But they don't bow down. So there are dissenters. And even though, yes, that Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, but they're certainly not acting like Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. They're not acting like good Babylonians, isn't it? And so they are accused and they get into a whole lot of trouble. And Nebuchadnezzar is extremely angry with them. But this is kind of a classic scenario, isn't it? You know, dictators don't like being contradicted. And dictators love having these kind of really huge, big parade type stuff. You know, is it Nuremberg? Is it North Korea or wherever it happens to be? You know, it just seems to be how dictators go on, isn't it? And they certainly don't like being contradicted. And so Nebuchadnezzar gets very angry with them. Well, let's look particularly at verses 13 and following. So Nebuchadnezzar is furious, isn't he? Because he's been contradicted. Is part of his fury because he does feel vulnerable? You know, have you noticed the smaller the person, the bigger the car they? I came in a big car. I arrived in a big car, Peter, and you're big, right? So there's But, you know, certainly driving around the city, you see these massive big Toyotas. How on earth do they park that in the Westfield car park? But there's these massive, huge, and there's this little tiny lady driving it, you know. Seems to work like that, isn't it? The smaller the person, the bigger the car. Well, there's a bit of this psychology going on here. You know, I mean, why is Nebuchadnezzar doing all this? Because he feels vulnerable. He feels as if, you know, he's been rattled by that dream. So there's a bit of psychology going on here. But so there's a lot of huffing and puffing by Nebuchadnezzar. Yes, he was, verse 13, Nebuchadnezzar is in furious rage. Yep, and he gives them a chance to deny the accusation. Verse 14, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, that you don't serve my gods or bow down to my image? But if you, when the royal orchestra starts up, verse 15, but we go through all the instruments again because we're mocking, you see. Bow down, well and good. But if you don't worship, it's going to be, yes, the burning fiery furnace. And here's our punchline. Not even God can save you. End of verse 15. Who is the God that will deliver you out of my hands? Not even God. But I suggest the measure of his fury and anger is also a measure of his feelings of vulnerability here. But not even God can save them. Well, we'll see that that's the punchline, you see. But there is a God, of course, who can deliver. So a wrong view of God, which is going to be corrected by the events in our chapter here. So Nebuchadnezzar's wrong view of God and the right view of God. So the three young men respond and they correct Nebuchadnezzar's theology. Now, so verses 16, 17, 18 are very, very important. Let me read them. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego answered the king. O Nebuchadnezzar, we've no need to answer you in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able. So they're contradicting. Who is able? No one can deliver Nebuchadnezzar. The God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known, O king, that we won't serve your gods or bow down to the golden image that you have set up. So here is a correct view of God. And of course, this is one of the great expressions of faith in the Old Testament. They're expressing their trust in God. Now, the distinction I want to draw here is it's faith, but it's not fanaticism. We can easily slip from one to the other. We're called to faith, but we're not called to be fanatics. Now, one of the ways in which faith slips to fanaticism is, and that's when we start becoming all pushy and rude and obnoxious, you know what I mean? When faith slips towards fanaticism, but another way it is shown here is, notice what they are saying. They believe that God is able to deliver, even from fiery furnace, right? They believe that God can deliver, faith. And yet, notice verse 18, they're not dictating, or verse 17, they're not dictating to God. No, verse 18 is verse 18. But if not, if he doesn't deliver, you see, they're still not going to bow down, right? They're not dictating what God does. They believe that God is able to deliver, but they're not insisting that he does. That's the difference between faith and fanaticism. Now, I wonder if we understand that difference, and what's our faith like? Because certainly there's very well-meaning Christian people go around the place who would find fault with the faith of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. They believe God can deliver, but they're not at all sure. And in fact, they're not demanding that God do so, you see. Now, there's another view of faith, you see, because you really haven't got faith unless you not only believe, I believe that God can cure me, and I believe God will cure me. So you really haven't got real faith. Unless you do the extra bit, you see. You know, you believe God can cure people, you know. He does that sometimes. You believe God can, but if you have more faith, maybe real faith, kind of faith you should have, you not only believe that God can, but you believe that he will. You claim it. You know, you believe he will. Well, can I suggest, that's probably bad theology, and maybe actually very, very unhelpful to the people concerned. They believe that God can, but they're not insisting that he will. You see, there's a view of God being expressed by the faith of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. They believe that God is absolutely sovereign. Fiery furnace, that's not a problem to God. He's absolutely sovereign. But they will also allow God his freedom. They're not dictating to God, you see. They're allowing God's freedom, God's free. He can decide what he wants to do in that situation, you see. And can I suggest that God is not really sovereign unless he's also free. God doesn't have to fit in with what I want to happen. Not even if I really want it to happen. He still doesn't have to fit in. He doesn't have to bow his will to my will. Now, it's up to God what he does. And in fact, if God has to fit in with every time I kind of pray and psych myself up so that I'm now not only convinced God can do it, but I'm convinced he's going to do it. If God has to be held captive to that, then he's not really sovereign, is he? So for God to be sovereign, he's also got to be free to use his absolute power as and when and how he wants to, you see. So the young men, they're expressing not only a proper view of faith rather than fanaticism, but they're also expressing a proper view of God. And one of the main ways it kind of goes around the place, it seems to be, you know, in that, I've already kind of said it, that issue of healing, isn't it? So my mother was a marvellous Christian who died comparatively young back in the day when rheumatoid arthritis, the cures were worse than the complaint. So basically, you know, killed by attempts to cure. But she died comparatively young. But, you know, that was something she had to sort out. You know, what did faith in God mean in that situation? Believe that God can heal. But am I insisting that God do so? Yeah, that's the faith that's on display here. We allow God his freedom. So, something for us to think about. I don't think we're meant to find fault with Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. God is able to deliver, and he will deliver us, but if not, it's not kind of, oh, if he's not able. No, if he does not, so will, you see. But if he does, if that's not his will, we allow him that freedom, you see. He's the sovereign God. He knows what's best. We only think we know what's best. Yep. And even when we really want something to happen, and we really can't work out why it wouldn't be the best, you know what I mean? For us or for that person, how can that not be the best? We've still got to allow God his freedom, don't we? Yep, so now as I suggested, Nebuchadnezzar's kind of maybe not as confident as he appears. That's why he's so angry. And if he's so confident that God is not able to deliver, why does he get the furnace heated up 7 times more than it usually is? But notice that verse 19. And why does he get the strongest men in the army to bind them? And so forth. That's to prevent the divine intervention that he fears might only too likely happen. No, he's not at all as confident as he's made to appear. And those three young men thrown in the furnace, well, they looked their best, didn't they? You know, they'd straightened their tie, they're wearing their hat, they combed their hair. You know, they looked magnificent as they've thrown, because they're thrown in with their full court dress, aren't they? Verse 21. These men, they were bound in their mantles, their tunics, their hats, their other garments. You know, man, they, you know, we're going to go, we're going to look good. And we discover it's more dangerous serving the king than God. because the guys who threw them in, they died. But the guys who went in didn't. So there's a lot of humour here. You know, Nebuchadnezzar's doing his best to resist God, and it's all kind of going very badly, isn't it? And there are the young men walking in the fire, aren't they? And when they get out of the fire, notice, not only haven't they been burnt, but there's not even the smell of fire. End of verse 7. And no smell of fire. They are totally untouched by this. Like when God delivers, he does a good job. You know, this is immaculate protection. You know, oh, they just managed to get out. You know, they're a bit singed, but oh, we made it. When God delivers, you know, they looked as good when they got out. They smelt as good as they got when they got out as when they went in. That's real deliverance. Yes, so in verse 27, that's right, yes. The hair of their head was not singed, their mantles were not harmed, no smell of the fire came from them. So God's total sovereignty is demonstrated, and apparently, obviously, it was also God's will that they be delivered. Now, who's that fourth figure in the fire? Well, the king says it's an angel, doesn't he? Yes, verse 28. Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, who sent his angel. So it may have been an angel, but actually Nebuchadnezzar's not very good at theology. So I'm not necessarily going to believe it was an angel just because Nebuchadnezzar says so. But we've got this mysterious fourth figure. He may well be right. Got a protected, you know. Anyway, it's expressing God's protection of the three young men. And so their stance for God is justified, and they are protected. So Nebuchadnezzar's impressed. It's not entirely sure, though, he's really understood things, because didn't this whole thing happen because he was threatening people with death? You know, if you don't do what I say, you're going to be thrown into the fiery furnace. Well, he's kind of changed his tune, but not. Now, notice in verse 29, if you don't bow down to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you'll be torn limb from limb. Not exactly the way that a Christian maybe should express stuff. You know, so he's kind of, again, he's kind of got it and he hasn't got it. Remember how I found fault with Nebuchadnezzar at the end of chapter 2? Because he says he's God of gods and Lord of lords. Sounds pretty good, but when you look a bit more closely, maybe it's not as impressive as it looks. I think it's a similar situation here. Everybody's got to bow down to the God of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. But it's kind of spoilt, isn't it, about being torn limb from limb, and their houses will be demolished and so forth. Yet no God can deliver this way. Fair enough. The three young men are promoted yet again. But it's not at all clear that Nebuchadnezzar has entirely understood things. Well, this is the God of the Bible. This is God we believe in. Now, how could God do this, you see? Well, we only need to think, don't we? He is the creator. And all the forces of nature are things that have been made by God. And so none of the forces of nature, be they gravitation or the laws of combustion or whatever, none of the laws of nature or how atoms move or whatever they do, none of those things are outside God's control. It's not as if any of them can resist God's will. So we only need to think about it. It's obvious that if God really is the sovereign creator, the one who made everything out of nothing, you see. See, God creates in the way we can't. You know, human sculptor, you get this lump of rock. Oh yes, you can chisel away and you can make this thing, but if there's a crack or if there's some imperfection in the rock, well, clever artist knows how to kind of, you know, get around those kind of things. But you know, but you've got to work with the material, you see. And there's some kind of limitation. But if you're creating everything out of nothing, there's no limitation. You are devising the very laws of nature, which therefore you can use and manipulate and do what you like if you're the sovereign God. So it's quite clear in terms of basic theology what God says. Nothing can resist his will because nothing is outside his will. So reason, you see, is the great friend of faith. So this miracle here, you know, an intelligent person can believe, yes, that really did happen. It's not suggesting it's going to happen every day. It's not suggesting, oh, if you only have enough faith, it'll always happen. In fact, the passage is not saying that, it's saying quite the opposite. God is sovereign, but we also allow him his freedom. But if there is a creator God, then obviously it stands to reason, you see, that God is able to do such a thing. And that trusting in a God like that, even when he doesn't answer our prayers the way we wanted him to, or even thought he should, even when he doesn't do that, even when he doesn't magically sort out every little problem we've got, it's entirely reasonable, you see, to trust in a God like that. So we're not people who kind of set faith and reason against each other, you know what I mean? The most intelligent thing that a highly intelligent person ever does is to trust in God, you see. don't get the idea that, oh, you know, it's only people who aren't very clever who become Christians. Now, the church is full of a whole lot of different types of people. But intelligence, properly used, is not going to get in the way of faith. Though it can if it's misused. Have I mentioned the intelligence trap? Intelligent people can always work out a really good sounding reason for not doing what they don't want to do. And they don't want to trust Jesus. They don't want to follow God, you know. So they're really good at, clever people are really good at thinking up really clever reasons to justify not trusting God. That's the intelligence trap. But that's misusing reason, isn't it? We only need to think about it. If there is a creator who's made all things from nothing, there's no limit to his sovereignty. But we also need to allow him his freedom, and our faith has to reflect that. Otherwise, there is something defective about our faith. So just notice that, faith, but not fanaticism. Yep, any thought or question, comment?
I always thought that Genesis 1:1, in some ways that's a giveaway into the Bible. If you don't get that, you don't get a lot else to work in the Bible.
Well, Genesis 1:1, yep. So there was nothing to start with. God made everything. The implications of that are kind of such a simple idea, but are profound, isn't it? You know, nothing can resist his will because everything is contingent. Everything kind of depends on God's will because there was nothing before that. And that makes every miracle that God wants to perform possible and understandable from that viewpoint. Yeah. Yep. Yes, Fiona.
I think also it's when you become a Christian too, that you live in the world
absolutely, and that's why no one can turn themselves into a Christian. You know, it's God at work in our lives, isn't it? Opening our blind eyes, helping us to see. It was there all along, but we never saw it until God opened our eyes. Yeah. Yep. Any other thought or question? Well, let's have our break, David. How long have we got?
10 minutes.
Oh, we've got him in a good mood today. He's